This is the Education Gadfly Show.
It's summertime and things are stopped not coming out.
Oh,
so
yeah, you noticed this was 2 months ago.
This was 2 months
ago. Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Gadfly of the Common Core World, Kathleen Porter-McGee.
Thank you.
Kathleen, welcome to the show. I cannot believe this is your first time being on the show.
I know.
It's, you know, this part of what is making this possible is that Kathleen and her family, including another famous school reformer, Mark Porter-McGee, he goes by the full name too, right?
He does, yeah.
I know, that's so cool.
That was an epic compromise in our marriage.
He's a 21st century guy there. Yet you guys have all moved down to Washington, D.C. It's so great to have you back.
Thank you. We're glad to be back.
Yes, so Connecticut now has two fewer school reformers. But to hell with them.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Con Can has to do this whole thing about how bad things are in Connecticut. You're doing fine. I mean, come on. It's not like you were coming from Mississippi or something. I'm just teasing you. Okay. Well, hey, it's great having you here in D.C. We're going to try to make Kathleen a regular on the show at least once a month. And that means we can talk a little more in depth about some curricular issues, things like that. Common Core stuff. You are watching the Common Core implementation. Is this like watching paint dry, Kathleen?
Oh, God. No, it's actually far more exciting if you are a curriculum and professional development geek, which I am. So
yes.
It's very interesting. There's some very interesting stuff going on.
Now, people, a lot of controversies. You know, it seems like in particular, English teachers are up in arms over this debate about teaching less fiction, more nonfiction. I saw that there was a book out called Read Aside. Something about, I don't know if it's Common Core or something else. School reform in general is killing reading.
Yeah, it's not true. But yes, there is a lot of there's a lot of hyperbole out there right now that somehow we're going to lose literature in classrooms. When, first of all, I would contend that there's probably less literature, less great literature being read than we think there is right now. And so hopefully this will actually increase it.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, we're going to talk about some timely topics this week, and then we'll get Amber's research minute. So let's start. Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Last week, the Department of Education rejected Iowa's NCLB waiver request. Why was this such a big risk for the Obama administration?
Shocked! I mean, I honestly was shocked on this one. This is without any sarcasm. I cannot believe that they did this. Look, Andy Rothenheim has argued that this is in line with everything else the Obama administration's done, saints that they are, not playing politics, calling it as they see it. And I think there's some truth to it. What I'm amazed about is we're only 4 months from the election. They're still doing it. This is a huge risk, it seems to me, to turn down. It's a swing state, Iowa is. All the politicos put that in the swing state category. And the reason they turned down Iowa is a waiver application under ESEA. It wasn't because of their accountability plan. It was because they refused to do a statewide teacher evaluation system, which, by the way, has nothing to do with accountability and is not anywhere in ESEA.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems crazy to me. It seems like the critique of federal overreach is just falling on deaf ears there. I mean, I'm very surprised.
So the other surprising thing was that the governor, who's a Republican, when this happened, rather than blaming the Department of Education or the president, he blamed his own legislature. And it was a legislature, I believe the Democratic House, maybe there in Iowa, that blocked a statewide teacher evaluation system from happening. So the governor and lieutenant governor had been pushing for that and trying to use the leverage from the feds to get it. I have a feeling, though, we might hear Terry Branstad, the governor, change his tune. He is the chair of the Romney campaign. I wouldn't be surprised if the Romney campaign encourages him to start blaming the president for this decision and for the fact that Iowa schools continue to suffer under the old No Child Left Behind AYP system.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. You know, there's about now five other swing states that have not yet heard about whether they've got flexibility under ESEA. They've applied for waivers, have not been approved yet. We will see if the administration continues to play policy, as Edgywalk Andy put it the other day.
It'll be interesting to watch.
Okay, topic number two.
Fordham just released its feedback on the first draft of the Next Generation Science Standards. Kathleen, how are these common standards shaping up, and should states consider adopting the final versions?
It's a great question. Should they consider adopting the final version? They should consider it, but they should take very seriously the question of whether they are better. The final draft will be better or worse than their current standards. We took a look at this draft. It is a draft, and it's not there yet. There's a lot of work that they need to do to bring it up to par and bring it up to speed. I think that the drafters are earnest in their desire to make it better, and we're hoping that they will. But right now, the standards aren't world-class, truly next-generation science standards.
Kathleen, would you say that these draft science standards suck, really suck, or really, really, really suck?
I don't want to go on record as saying either of the three, but there is much room for improvement with the science standards.
Yeah, we have been very careful to be constructive, but needless to say, we are not super enthusiastic about this first round. A lot of work yet to be done. What's the problem? What did they get wrong? I mean, we've identified some what we think are some great state science standards mm-hmm. out there. They could have just adopted those. They did not. What did they get wrong in this process?
I think one of the biggest things that they got wrong is the balance of content and process standards is wildly off, and there's much too much of a focus on process standards. In fact, they tried to shove process standards into just about every content standard, even when it didn't make any sense, and that ended up overcomplicating many, many of the standards.
Process standards, like how to do science, how
exactly.
to think like a scientist.
Yeah. And it's complicated because in science, process is actually really important. In other right. content areas, you could just say, just focus on the content, not mm-hmm. on the process. In science, I do think it is important, but I think that they've overblown the importance and it's dwarfing the content.
Yes. And by process, I would include in that the scientific process.
Right.
Yes. one of the only scientific processes I know.
Yeah,
but I'm sure there's others good. That I should learn too. Okay, good. No, I know. They have excitement about inquiry and all kinds of things and thinking like a scientist, again, which is great, but you can only do that if you know some science.
Exactly right. And that is what's lost here.
And my understanding is, you know, in the desire to try to have these standards be fewer, because that's part of the mantra, fewer, clearer, higher, you know, instead of actually being selective on, okay, we're going to choose which content, it's more just like, well, let's just say, instead of having 10 standards about this piece of physics, we'll just say, we'll have one standards and we'll say, learn physics.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that there's way too much implied in each standard and yeah. not enough that's explicit. And so I don't think they've made some of the crucial prioritization decisions that they had hoped to make. And hopefully yeah. they'll be clearer about those priorities in the next rounds.
Okay, topic number three, Ty.
Fordham's home state of Ohio recently enacted a third grade reading requirement. Should other states make passing a reading test a prerequisite to moving up to fourth grade?
Kathleen, where do you come down on this? Because yeah. I am so torn on this one.
Yeah, I come down pretty strongly against the state dictating that the students should pass a third grade reading test. It just feels like micromanagement from the state level. I am completely against social promotion. I do believe that students need to be held to really rigorous standards, but I just see the law of unintended consequences is going to come down really, really strong. I really feel like the compromise with standards and accountability driven reform is that you need to allow some flexibility, and we're kind of using a blunt force object to try to say that everybody needs to do this, and this is going to be good for all students. And you're always going to find exceptions, and there's always going to be some nuance, and there are going to be some schools who are maybe able to do some creative things with students who came in behind. And I feel like trying to dictate this level of micromanagement from the state level is a disaster in the making.
Yeah, no, look, that's my instinct as well. But look, our colleagues in Ohio who have been pushing this, brought in some folks from Florida, talk about how it's been going down there. They say a couple of things. First of all, it has gone well in Florida. Most of the evidence is that the students are performing better. They've been smart about the way they've implemented it, making sure that kids who do have to spend another year in third grade get the help they need. It seems like it's going pretty well now over a decade in Florida. The other thing is, as much as I like your same impulses, leave it to the schools, it just wasn't happening, right? There's just not a culture of actually making sure kids are ready for the next grade. Just all the, I don't know, professional incentives or the culture or whatever else is to pass kids along. So I guess the argument is, look, you know, we're waiting and waiting and waiting for schools to do the right thing here. They haven't been. It's a critical time period. A little nudge is going to be necessary.
I guess I would say there's one other thing that's worth considering, and I wish policymakers would consider the whole landscape and not just an individual policy. You know, there's a little thing called the Common Core Aligned Assessments, which are going to come down the pike and be more rigorous, and how many third graders are going to be caught up with this policy once the new Common Core assessments come down the pike, and how is the state going to accommodate for that?
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah. See, in my kids' Waldorf school, this would be a huge problem because once they get into grade school, they do this looping idea where the teacher stays with the class mm-hmm. the whole time. Mm-hmm. So if you have to stay behind, if you don't get to move on to the fourth grade, all your classmates go on and your teacher. boy, do you feel left out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Thankfully, they don't really have standards in Waldorf schools, so I don't think that's ever happened. All right. That is all the time we've got for this week on Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Isn't it great having Kathleen in the office?
It is great in the office, indeed.
The office has a new buzz now. We've got Kathleen, plus a couple of new folks that have joined us recently, plus, a whole stable of interns.
Slew of interns, yes.
And by the way, we do not do this practice that Charles Murray and others have complained about of not paying our interns. We pay our interns, or in some cases, other programs pay our interns. But they get paid, is my point.
It's like a token. I don't know if it's a payment. It's a thank you, I think, is what our interns would say.
All right. Well, what you got for us this week?
We had a new report out by Calder. It was actually released a couple months ago. It's by Helen Ladd. It examines a couple questions. One, whether teachers in the lower elementary grades, when we're talking about K-2 here, are of lower quality than those in the upper elementary grades, 3-5. And two, whether school-based accountability policies like those under NCLB and other state accountability systems might contribute to these differences. Her hypothesis was that accountability might have a potentially negative drawback because higher quality teachers end up in the tested grades while lower quality teachers end up in the untested grades. Seems reasonable. The results of the study indicate that the answer to both questions is yes. Ladd and colleagues use teacher licensure test scores, which is important as the proxy for effectiveness because they don't have value-added scores in all the grades. There's lower grades. Looked at North Carolina. Love North Carolina. So much good data in North Carolina. For 95 through 2009, which covered pre-accountability age, state accountability, and NCLB age, she finds that not only do teachers in the upper elementary grades have higher licensure scores, but the accountability of the NCLB variety increased the shortfall in teacher quality from lower to upper grades. Not surprisingly, schools tend to move teachers of higher quality from the lower to upper grades and vice versa. Then she proved, basically through a bunch of different models, that the pre-accountability area and the state accountability area also saw this movement in these shortfalls, but it was more pronounced under NCLB, which she attributed to the more negative sanctions. I guess the AB system, ABC, was a little more positive or maybe didn't have sanctions. Concludes that the accountability policies induce pressure that work to the disadvantages of students in lower grades, and maybe we should be concerned about this because we're pouring all this money into early childhood, which instantly these programs aren't that great, and then they get these crummy teachers.
So I'm kind of disappointed here with Helen Ladd on this one. I mean, I thought that so much of the teacher value-added stuff is proving that these proxies are not very good proxies.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I mean, and she goes through and kind of talks about that. But yeah, I mean, actually the licensure scores is a little different than licensure, right? So she's looking at the scores on the test.
Yeah, this is verbal ability.
And, right, so that's a little bit better than, you know, some of our other...
All right, so basically the smarter teachers are getting moved into the later grades. And the dumber teachers are...
If you think that that's what the high test scores mean, this was someone who did not score that well in the SAT, so anyway.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you're a principal, does this strategy really make sense? Or I would think you'd want to actually have a string of good teachers in the lower grades so your kids are doing better coming into those tested grades, no? I mean, especially under the No Child Left Behind era where it was all status, there was no growth piece to this, you'd think you'd want your, you know, kids to have learned to read already in first and second grade.
You certainly would, but you don't want them to then lag in third grade. So it's this sort of catch-22.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this idea that a really dynamic teacher can like really move mountains in that one grade, you know, that she can really bring up those deficiencies. So, yeah, I mean, and I think Helen Ladd's, you know, sort of been banging this drum for a while that accountability is good, but there's some negative consequences. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's been studying this for a long time.
Yeah.
And she's actually one, which she's for what you're for, sort of an inspectorate kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So let's supplement accountability and high stakes and that sort of thing with these sort of like real informed opinions of people that go and visit the school and so on and so forth.
And that way the inspectors can come in and ask the principals, are you assigning all your dumbest teachers to kindergarten? Now, I'm just teasing, of course. Look, what's interesting is that this was in place before the accountability as well. And I think it makes some sense. I mean, we have this stereotype of the very sweet kindergarten teacher. And maybe, you know, there might be other attributes beyond, say, performance on a test score that's going to count. I mean, you've got to have, you know, incredible patience and something very special to be a kindergarten teacher that may not relate very much to scores on the licensure exam. Right. Maybe as you get to third, fourth, fifth grade, you're really into more content and into all of that. So, you know, you just have different kinds of people who want to go to those different different kinds of skills.
That's fair.
I mean, do teachers still feel, I mean, when you're closer to this stuff than I am, Kathleen, I mean, do you have a sense of, you know, somebody's becoming an elementary school teacher. Do they, when they're training, have a vision like, I want to teach kindergarten, I want to teach third grade, fifth grade? And people have strong preferences around that stuff.
Yeah,
right?
I think definitely. I mean, you might say I can teach fourth or fifth or fourth, fifth or sixth, but I think there's people who go into saying I want to teach, you know, upper elementary or middle are a lot different than the teachers who go in and say I really want to be a kindergarten teacher. It definitely is. It's a different group of kids entirely, and you know, it takes a different a personality, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, would never have made it as an elementary school teacher myself.
I always say first grade is the hardest year to teach, and I would not have been a good first grade teacher.
Why is that? Why is it first grade?
I mean, there's just so much going on. I think it's a big transition year. Kids are really learning how to read, and teaching kids how to read is hard. I mean, and you really need to get it right, and you still need all of that kindergarten patience, and you really need to be. I think first grade teachers in particular are unsung heroes.
Yes.
I mean, you're still mothering. They're mothering and they're teaching.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like at high school, you're like whipping them to shape, you know, trying to crack the whip and get them going.
We know what Amber was like as a teacher.
Light up, shut up, test
that. And we get to see that now with our interns. Amber gets them into shape. All right, good. Well, it was a pleasure having you on the show, Kathleen.
Thanks.
Amber, thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you
for. I like how you had to go in a little bit, dig deep there to a study, because frankly, it's summertime and things are stopped not coming out.
Oh yeah, you noticed this was 2 months ago.
This was 2 months ago. Well, in the spirit of that, we will be off for the 4th of July next week. But until the week after that,
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee,
and I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.